This is Digital Story Podcast number 768, December 8th, 2020. Today's theme is Document What You Do. I'm Derek Story. One of the best ways to put our photography skills to work is for documenting projects. Home improvement, car restoration, or simply cleaning out the garage are great examples of this endeavor. Today, I'm going to discuss my documentation of a 1976 Lafayette LR2200 stereo receiver that I restored. It was a terrific project, and I have the images to prove it. I hope you enjoy the show. So, being a California boy, I wasn't as familiar with Lafayette radio electronics as folks who lived in New York and New Jersey and on that side of the country. But in their day, they were a big deal. They were a big deal. They went up against the likes of Radio Shack and Heathkit and those kind of folks in terms of mail order electronics, and they had stores to boot. I became interested in them when I saw a few of their stereo receivers for sale on eBay, and I was thinking, those are kind of cool. You know what I mean? You know, when you're just kind of browsing around and you go, that's a nice looking piece of equipment there. Yeah, so I was initially attracted to their design, but as I read up on them, I saw that many people like the way they sound as well. They had that nice sort of analog warm sound that so many people like with vintage stereo receivers and amplifiers. Now, they did have retail stores back in the day, Lafayette, mostly in New York and New Jersey, as I mentioned earlier. But their catalog business is really the big deal in their lifespan. And if you live somewhere where your electronic shop was maybe a mom and pop that had limited selection or limited inventory, you could get a 400-page Lafayette Electronics catalog and just see everything that you wanted to see. You know, the pages were filled with tape recorders and microphones and stereo systems, CB radios, and more and more and more. They began their business in 1931. Like so many businesses of that time, they started out with a different name. I don't even recall what it was, but it evolved into Lafayette Electronics. By the 60s and 70s, you were seeing their ads in Popular Electronics, Stereo Review, and all of that. And they had a number of store locations, too. I believe at their peak, they had something like 150 store locations. Again, most of them on the east side of the United States. The LR2200 that I purchased sold for $299 in 1976. It had a walnut finished wood case. It featured 27 watts per channel. It had dual tuning meters, a source selector switch for phono, FM, FN mute, MPX FIL filter, AM, and auxiliary. It also had advanced features such as low noise transistors and phase lock loop stereo FM circuit for improved separation and low distortion. In addition to all of that, it looked great. It's really a handsome looking receiver. And you'll see plenty of shots of it because I documented my restoration project of it. So you'll be able to get a good look at it. So I found my working unit on eBay for $45. It was like the perfect restoration project in the sense that with a little bit of work, and I'm talking about just a couple hours of work, you could have something that looked 10 times better than what you started with. And you got it for a low price because, you know, one of the things about how eBay works is that if something looks really crappy, obviously, I mean, that makes total sense, right? However, when you know how to restore things, you can look at things and say, that only requires an hour's worth of work or 2 hours worth of work, or I know how to, you know, get the part for that or whatever. And then suddenly those become, you know, hidden gems. Those become treasures that you can get for a low price and then bring them back to life. And, you know, that's definitely what I thought I could do with this. Now, it's funny. It took a long time for it to come. It came from New York, of course, right? Because I guess that's where a lot of those electronics are, even though it was a mail order business as well. It came from New York in a large Huggies diapers box that was split open on two sides, and then it had styrofoam popcorn leaking out the broken areas of the box. I mean, this box was possibly the ugliest box that ever arrived on my front doorstep at the studio. In fact, I'm pretty sure that driver who delivered it could not get it out of his truck fast enough. You know what I mean? I think I remember hearing it land on my doorstep. I'm not even sure if he set it down all the way. I just sort of heard this plop, which probably made the seams split even more. So when I opened up the door and I looked and I saw this giant box with styrofoam leaking out for Huggies diapers that was randomly taped in odd places, I was going, oh, that's probably my stereo component there. Because, what else would come in that kind of box? And in my documentation project, I did not photograph that thing because it's already laser beamed into my memory. I'll never be able to get it out. And I don't want that to happen to anyone else. So I skipped that first step. When it was time to work on it, the first thing that I do is a preliminary test. Just to make sure that if I do all this work on this, you know, there's a chance that it's going to function properly after I do all this work on it. So, you know, I plug it in, make sure the meters light up, you know, start, you know, checking things like this. Now, at this time, I did not know that the right channel was out because I didn't have speakers connected to it. I just wanted to see if everything lit up and, you know, if there was power to it. So there was. So I go, okay, all right, this is going to be worth working on. So then what I decided to do is I got my Fujifilm X100V and I said, okay, I'm going to use this camera to document. And, you know, the reason why I reach for that particular camera a lot on these sort of things is, quite honestly, it's easy. I mean, it's just easy. I don't have to worry, you know, is the right lens on there? Do I have to change the lens? Do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? I don't have to do anything. I just pull it out of its little bag and I turn it on and I'm ready to go. It has a flip screen. It has electronic levels, all that stuff. So I said, okay, I'm going to use this. And so I documented, the first few steps. I took off the wood case, which is very easy to do on vintage stereo receivers because they only have four retaining screws on the side. And you can just lift that wood case off and then you can look right into, you know, the heart of this machine, which I just love doing. I love that first look where you're looking into this thing and you go, man, that's handmade. I mean, that is a handmade piece of electronics there. So I took the wood off and I examined it and I said, okay, I'm going to have to do some work on the wood. It's thirsty. I mean, it was thirsty and it was dirty. I used Murphy's oil soap on it to clean it initially. And then I actually use liquid gold, for the finishing touch on the wood. So I set it aside and, you know, kind of looked around, tried to determine how much cleaning I was going to have to do, looked for loose wires, that kind of thing. By the way, it's unplugged at this point. Take some more pictures, right? Just sort of take pictures. And, you know, the pictures part is very interesting because, I mean, that's the thrust of the show, right? Documenting these projects. I'm just telling you about a particular project. Sometimes when I'm working on something, I get in a zone. It's like when I'm in a photography zone and you don't want to stop because, you know, one thing leads to another and then you're really curious about this, but you can't get this screw out and you're trying to figure that out, you know, and you kind of fall into it. And taking pictures along the way sometimes can disrupt that flow. But I think that it's also a matter of attitude because the way that I look at it is that when I'm taking pictures, that gives me a chance to think about what I'm doing. It's a little pause where I can contemplate my next move. And possibly that could save me from making a bad move because you get in a thing and you get frustrated. You say, okay, I'm just going to get the pliers and yank this mother off, right? And, that's probably not the best move 99.9% of the time. So I think that the documenting process actually slows me down a bit, and I like that. I like that part of it. So I took some pictures of the inside, and then I noticed that the knobs were loose, and especially the main knob, which is the one that we use to turn on the power. So almost all the time when knobs are loose, there's a retaining ring. You just have to find out how to get to that retaining ring and then tighten it. Just over years, you know, they get loose. So fortunately with this bad boy, the front plate would come off as well. And it needed to come off anyway because it really needed to be cleaned. It was pretty yucky. It had some scratches on it, all that. So I managed to get the front plate off, and then I had access to the retaining rings for all the knobs. And I go, all right, I'm in business. And sure enough, the one that was really loose was just a retaining ring. I tightened that up right away. It works great. And it's a great switch. I love this. It's one of those switches that is just solid. Like when you go from off to on with this thing, it just goes click like that. I mean, it is decisive in its clickness. And I can see how that retaining ring over years, you know, over 40 years, 50 years could get loose because of that turbo. It's tough. So I got all that stuff sort of fixed up. And I decided to start cleaning things. And so then I'm taking more pictures and thinking about what I'm going to clean next and all of that. And I didn't find too many other problems with it. Now, remember, I hadn't discovered that the right channel was out yet. That's still to come. But at this point, I'm feeling pretty good that now this has basically evolved into a cleaning and restoring project and not a whole lot of fixing to be done, which is, those are the best kind. I was really happy about that. So I'm taking pictures and cleaning, taking pictures. I loved working on the wood cabinet. You know, it turned out really well. I got the faceplate nice and clean, and you know, it turned out really well. I had to clean all the knobs. All the knobs, whoever had owned it last or whoever owned it somewhere along the line, had put like tape on the knob, like scotch tape, you know, the where it just like leaves this residue. I you know, 1970s or 80s scotch tape, it is a whole different ball game than what we have now. And I actually had to get some stainless steel cleaner. It's a paste that I use for heavy duty projects on those knobs. And it did work. And it still took some elbow grease. I mean, that residue, cellophane tape residue, is wicked, wicked stuff. So I get everything cleaned up. I'm taking pictures along the way. I get it put back together. And I decide to, you know, take some photos of the finished thing. And when I get to the tips part, I'm going to tell you that this is one of the most important stages, is those hero shots. So I'm taking some nice shots. I'm feeling really good about the project at this point. I'm like 3 hours into this, and I feel like I'm done. So I go to hook some speakers up to it and fire it up. That's when I discovered the right channel was out. Now, there was that moment of, oh, no, you know, that moment where you just go, all this work and, oh, no. So I went to the back again, and I noticed a lot of receivers I work on, they'll have one fuse for the whole kit and caboodle. This one had three fuses, and two of them were for the channel. So it had a fuse specifically for the left channel and a fuse specifically for the right channel. Sure enough, pull the fuse out and it smoked. It smoked. I don't know what happened to it. I don't think it happened while I was working on it. So I put a new fuse in it. Everything works perfectly, and it's worked perfectly ever since. So then I did some more hero shots with it in working form, you know, with a turntable on top and all of that. And I've been using this receiver to this day. I absolutely love it. It has great sound. The FM, the built-in FM antenna, is so good. It has that little thing on the back that I don't even need an external FM antenna. This is the first time that's ever happened to me. And it just pulls in channels and they sound fabulous. I'm running it to a couple Poke audio speakers, two-way speakers. Really nice stuff. So I'm super enjoying it, my $45 investment. Let's talk about the actual tips for documenting, because I have all the steps for this. I publish them in the show notes and also on my Flickr page. I don't think I put every step in the show notes. I put the major ones, but there are more shots on the Flickr page. So if you click on any of the shots in the show notes. It'll take you to the Flickr page and you can see the rest of them there. These were fun to work on because you sort of get to relive the project while you're working on the photos. You know, and I'm going, man, ooh, that was gross. You know, that kind of stuff. And now it's so pretty, right? So I have 5 tips for when you're in the process of documenting these projects, just things to keep in mind. The first thing is work area aesthetics. Now, this, of course, depends on the job itself, but on smaller jobs like this one where I'm refurbishing a piece of equipment, I have an area that I use when I know I'm going to be doing pictures, and it's different than my workbench. This area is a nice white Formica counter, and is right by a north window. And I love this because it's perfect for taking pictures as well. I know I stand and work at the counter, and I have this nice lighting coming in. I don't have to add supplemental lighting. I don't have to do anything. I have nice soft lighting coming in through the north window. I use the Fujifilm X100V, and I can just take as I work. And having an area to work that looks good really makes the pictures look a lot better. As we know, when we look at a lot of shots on eBay and so forth, you know, they're in these like really bad looking garages and stuff like this. And I'm just going, ooh, you know, I understand that, you know, it lived there for a while, but I don't want to see that. I don't want to know. I don't want to know your history, right? Right. So I like having a nice clean work area. Now, if it's a bigger project, let's say that, you know, you're remodeling the kitchen, then what I think about for work area aesthetics is time of day for the photography, right? Because there are going to be times of day where the lighting in that area is better than others. So note that, you know, maybe start noting that a few days ahead of time so that when you want to do pictures, you know when to go, because you don't want to have to take pictures in terrible lighting because it doesn't do justice to the work that you're doing on the project. So that is like an added layer to the project itself, which is thinking about the work area aesthetics, time of day for the lighting. Can you move this project, if it's a smaller project, to somewhere that looks more pretty? You know, that kind of stuff. It really pays off when you're looking at the shots later on. The second tip, make each shot interesting. So even though I'm saying we're documenting what we do, but we're photographers and we're artists, so we have the unique opportunity really to use our skills to make these shots look as pretty as possible. You know, so for instance, you know, color balance and lighting and, you know, angle and composition, you know, all these things that make photographs look really nice. Make that effort, put in that little bit of extra time. It's not very much extra time, but try to make each shot, no matter how dull that particular step in the project might be, try to make it as interesting as possible. I'll give you an example, and you can see it on the Flickr page. Those knobs, I had to take all the knobs off the Lafayette receiver because they were just in terrible shape. And I, you know, I didn't want to try to clean them on the machine. And plus, I had to take them off to get the front face off anyway. So when I took the picture of the knobs, I just didn't have this, you know, this jumble of knobs there. I actually lined them up, and I always keep the knobs or whatever in the same order that they're going to go back on the device. So if you're taking cabinet doors off, make sure you remember where they came from, that kind of thing. If you're taking knobs off, make sure you remember where they came from on the device so you can put them back the way that they're supposed to be. So I had them in that order anyway. And then I just lined them up so they looked really nice. I even put the tuner knob, which is bigger, you know, up above them in basically the same position that it would be if it mounted on the stereo. And I really tried to get a good shot. Now, we're just talking about knobs here, right? You know, it's not nearly as sexy as like the internal electronics of this device. But I want every shot to be as interesting as I possibly can make it, because then your overall documentation will just hang together so much nicer. Third tip, use your electronic levels. Now, if you're shooting with a mirrorless camera, you probably have electronic levels that are easy to use. If you're shooting with a DSLR, many of the newer ones have them, but they're sometimes a little bit more cumbersome. If you have them, use them, because I think they're really helpful to get that constant reminder as you're lining up these shots and as you're sort of looking, especially when you're shooting from weird angles, sometimes it's sort of hard to tell where level is. Now, that doesn't mean that I think every shot that I take of the project needs to be leveled out. I don't. But one of the shots that I take of each step will be level, and then I'll play around with some other angles and things like that. So I always want a leveled shot in there, and those electronic levels really help to make that happen. I love electronic levels. It's one of my favorite things in mirrorless cameras. Number four, pay particular attention to the hero shots at the end. These hero shots are important because they're really the lasting memory of this thing right after you finished working on it. I mean, this is the moment. I mean, the steps along the way are indeed chapters to your story, but the ending of the story is the real payoff. So spend a little extra time on those shots. Get a couple hero shots that you really like. This will probably be the last time you photograph this particular item, whatever it happens to be. So you're already in the groove. You already have images, earlier images of it on the card. Go ahead and finish it off and do some really nice hero shots at the end. You'll be really thankful that you did. And then finally, this last tip is for people who shoot with smartphones, and smartphones are excellent for documenting, you know, these sort of projects because they're handy and they give you good image quality. So I definitely do not rule out smartphones at all. However, if you're going to use a smartphone, keep in mind that's probably geotagging all of the images. And if you're going to publish those images or share them somewhere like on Flickr or Facebook, make sure that you have those geotags, that location data, removed before you published. Because let's say that you're refurbishing your garage, right? And now the finished shot is this beautiful garage. You have all these cool tools lined up on pegboard, and you've got, you know, everything organized, and you got some nice stuff in there, right? Because you like to work in your garage. So you don't want to advertise the location of where all this expensive equipment is located, right? You know, not to the whole world anyway. So just make sure that if you're using your smartphone that you clear out those geotags. Like I use Photos for macOS. When I export the images out of Photos for macOS, it gives me the option to include or not include the location data. If I'm going online with those shots, I always take out that location data if it's anywhere around my house or my studio, because I just don't want that information, you know, out there for people that I don't know, quite honestly, for people that I don't know. So watch out for geotagging with smartphones. So those are my five tips. I love documenting things. I really do. And especially right now, you know, we're limited in our travel. We're limited in some of the things that we normally get to photograph. So embarking upon a cool project and documenting can scratch a couple itches. One, it can, you know, give us a cool project to work on, which is great right now. And then also allow us to really, you know, work on our photography skills as well. So I want to talk about Lafayette just to close the story out and why we don't see them anymore. And the major blow came in 1977. Lafayette was really big into CB radios. That was one of their bread and butter products. And in 1977, the FCC, they expanded the radio spectrum from 23 channels to 40 channels in 1977. Well, this really messed Lafayette up because they had tons of firm commitments to accept delivery of thousands of older designed units capable only of 23 channels. They had already set up everything. They did not know this was coming, apparently. Everything was in motion for all these CB radios with 23 channels. And they could not liquidate the inventory without having to take a serious loss. It was a punch to the gut. And eventually, according to Wikipedia, all of the old CB radios were sold for under $40. So along with the increased competition from Radio Shack and all the other things they were dealing with, including this huge loss on their CB radios, in 1981, they entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And several of the stores were purchased by Circuit City, but You know, of the 150 stores that Lafayette had in its heyday, only 8 stores remained when Circuit City took over. And then, of course, Circuit City has gone away, and so has Radio Shack, right? So it's very interesting, the arc of, you know, these companies. And, you know, from their great heyday, and I have some of the PDF catalogs, and they're just so amazing, to then, you know, taking a couple major blows, and next thing, they're gone. They're gone. But I have my restored LR2200 stereo receiver, so I have a little bit of Lafayette history. I love the way the tuner and the meters light up. It sounds fantastic. This was a good project for me, and I have pictures every step of the way. The Essential Steps to Impressive Video Conferencing. This is one of the titles that I made in the early part of the pandemic, and it's doing really well. And I just wanted to remind you that I have this 1-hour training video. It's $14.95, and it really helps you up your game for Zoom, Skype, Microsoft Teams, all those online conferencing activities that so many of us are doing so often these days. So it focuses on audio, video, and environment. I walk you through all sorts of different ways, including using gear that you already have, suggesting gear that you might want if you want to up your audio or up your video, image, picture, that kind of stuff. Lots of great tips. And it's a fast hour. It's a fast hour. It really is. If you're interested in upping your game, your video conferencing game, just go to thenimblephotographer.com, click on workshops, and you'll see it right there. Or in the show notes, I have links directly to the title. You can download it for $14.95. The way it works is the order comes in, and then I send you the links and the password to it within 24 hours of the order. And it's a lot of fun, and I think you'll enjoy it. How to capture excellent landscape images despite bright, clear skies. This is so funny. This reminds me of one of my workshop attendees. I haven't seen him for a bit. Jerry, if you're out there, I hope you're listening. Where he came to a number of my workshops, I think 4 or 5 over the years. And he used to say that he was cursed by clear skies. And every time we had a landscape workshop or something, we'd have no clouds. And he goes, yeah, that's because I'm here, right? And I thought of him when I saw this article. But this is a real challenge for all of us. And on Petapixel, and I have the link to the article, and most importantly, the movie that this photographer does on how to overcome, you know, these bright, clear days, techniques for that. Let me just read you a little bit about what Petapixel says, and then you can go watch the movie. Successful landscape photographers usually mix interesting skies and compelling foregrounds, but what if the sky is totally clear and the sun is harsh and unflattering? In this 13-minute video, Michael Shanebloom shows you how he makes the best of this kind of situation. There are few more deflating feelings for a landscape photographer than arriving at what is normally a great photo location only to be met by completely clear skies. In Shane Bloom's case, not only were there no clouds, but also a pervasive wind that prevented him from even flying his drone. Rather than just call it a skunked day, he explains how he made the most of the situation by focusing on detail-oriented images made with a telephoto lens. Shane Bloom shows you how he finds natural formation that draws the eye based on the textures and available lighting. While the idea of photographing rocks isn't particularly glamorous, what Shane Bloom manages to make out of what would have normally been a boring, bad photography situation is impressive. So, you know, essentially what he's talking about is that, you know, you just shoot differently. You're not going to shoot this big, wide panoramic landscape because you just have a solid blue sky and you have pretty contrasty stuff in parts of your scene. So you find elements within the scene that you can isolate, generally speaking, with a telephoto lens, and work on those. And that can be interesting, especially if you're in the place for more than one day, because it's a little bit like documenting in that you can document different components of the scene. And then if before you leave, something really good happens, you get a great sky, then you can do the hero shot and you have the components too. So it's a fun video. It's not very long and it's definitely worth taking a look at. You can get to it through the link in the show notes and take you right to the article on Petapixel. All right, just a little Virtual Camera Club business. First of all, I want to thank our Inner Circle members. These are the artists that support this podcast and this community month in and month out. Thank you so much, Inner Circle members. I've got some new goodies coming down the pike for you, so stay tuned to your Patreon page. And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of this podcast, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. It'll take you over to our site. You can look around, and hopefully you will join this great group of people that care about this show and care about this community. Also want to mention that I have a couple affiliate links in this podcast, and those will take you directly to, you know, B&H or Amazon, depending on, you know, where those links are to. I also have the tiles. Know that those links are coded for me, and that if you go there via one of these links, then I will get credit for your purchases. It's not a lot of money, but it does add up over time, especially when hundreds and hundreds of people are using them, and it doesn't cost you anything more. Those of you who stop by the site, click on Amazon or B&H tiles, and then do your shopping, I appreciate you taking that extra step. It does add up and it does help the show. And finally, a big thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the printing gurus. They are the magicians of output. They have everything that I need for my printing projects, and I suspect for you as well. Go over there and take a look. It's still not too late to get some fine art cardstock. Remember all that good stuff that I talked about last week. Some of those projects can really wow your friends and family, and it's not too late to get going on them. Click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. I give you stock numbers and all that, so you can do square greeting cards, panorama greeting cards, square framed prints of your Instagram shots, all that good stuff using Red River Paper. And a big thanks to them for sponsoring the show, longest running sponsor of our show. And they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/Red River Paper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm working on some great stuff for next week. Come back and join me then. Until then, stay safe, be creative, document something, and then join me again next Tuesday for another show. Bye-bye now.